Now I'll continue with the second half of World Watchers. This is Mae Brussel. It's program 840. Just to give you a rundown quickly of the way the article is written in the Miami Herald, it tells how Jeb Bush, when he called in Washington to Health and Human Services, never mentioned Rick Carey's being in jail, never said he had chronic trouble paying bills, that there were bitter lawsuits against him in the state of Florida, that he was a bad risk, and Jeb Bush was pushing for this particular character. I can't imagine why. The article says Rick Carey was indicted on charges of bribery, wiretapping, and he quickly got passports for two preschool children, disappeared, left the scandal behind, and three people from his organization have been indicted and are facing charges. While he disappeared, he left three associates who were convicted of bribery. They paid union leaders to try to direct their union health care and their contracts to their company to bolster what the private sector would be, because they couldn't bring in people from the private sector. And then it turned out the bribe wasn't necessary, because with Jeb Bush and Lynn Nofziger and Mr. Sears campaigning for this guy, they got their waiver anyway, and so that this special lobbying actually wasn't necessary, but they've been charged with it. And as I say, he has left the country. Now, this all came to a head just this last summer in 1987. Rick Carey left, and in April of 87 is when in Miami it first came to a head. And I noted that very conveniently, as soon as the Iran-Contra affair came down, that many of the witnesses were dead from the CIA as soon as the story began to break. And one of them was Santos Trafficante, who died March 19th, 1987. And it was with 1 month or so when publicly the story linked him to Jeb Bush, Lynn Nofziger, John Sears, Paula Hawkins, and Health and Human Services, and Trafficante. Sure, he was 72, but he and Mr. Lansdale and a team that were working with the Iran-Contra outfit conveniently all died. Mike Burke, heads of the CIA, within a very short time when this affair was getting unraveled, including William Casey and Admiral Moreau and Cyrus Hashemi, a team of 10 or 13 that I'll put on the air soon of major witnesses. Trafficante was gone. Now, this story tells how Rick Carey always wanted to have a hospital plan, that he had worked hard on it. He had seen his uncle in Cuba running a clinic there. So when he came to the United States, he thought he would try to build up a hospital and get a set of clinics going like his uncle had in Cuba. And in 1970, there were hospital scandals. There was embezzlement of $200,000 from a hospital. He was in charge of the books, and nobody said anything about it. He wasn't apprehended or even a suspect where the $200,000 went, even though he was in charge of the books. Then he forgot to pay his income taxes, and the IRS caught up with him in 1973, and he spent 30 days in jail. Then a local doctor's group wanted to build a new hospital near the Golden Glades interchange, and they needed money, according to this story. And the investors offered Rick Carey to be in on the deal if he would approach mafia boss Santo Trafficante and financier Robert Vesco for the money to build the hospital. Well, with his father and uncle and all their family coming out of Batista's Cuba, but they would know Trafficante, surely, even people like Frank Sturgis of Watergate fame or from the Grassy Knoll. He was the keeper of the games table down, one of the gambling places in Cuba. And with the Cuban contacts and Trafficante and Vesco's contacts in Cuba, and then for the intelligence community, they asked him to approach these persons. And it's very important to remember that Arthur Lyman of Iran-Contra hearings has a client named Robert Vesco, the same man who was supposed to investigate the Iran-Contra affair, very nicely left out all the drug connections and the scandals. And this could be very powerful reason why this story hasn't come north of Florida, really not breaking the headlines. And it should. Arthur Lyman is the attorney for Robert Vesco and also Willard Zucker, the banker who does work for the National Security Council, for the Special Delta Forces, for Secord and Hakim, and the secret team who harbors away their $8 million over there in Europe from the weapons deals. Willard Zucker is also a partner attorney representing Robert Vesco. So Vesco's name appears now in this article and in this story, along with the notorious Lynn Nofziger, the lobbyist. Now, the paper in Miami had a chart, who gains and who loses. And they have a picture of the cast of characters, and it tells about Lynn Nofziger, who is lobbying for this hospital plan to go through, and he got $400,000 for that. And being as he's the man who moved in the White House to redo the whole sub-cabinet, along with Helene Von Dahm from TCI and from California, to make over the far right underbelly of the entire Reagan administration in key positions. That's pretty heavy-duty stuff for a man down in Florida to be able to get Lynn Nofziger, paying him $400,000. And then he got John Sears, who was the Reagan campaign manager until William Casey came in for the hard-knuckle fighting and the stealing of Jimmy Carter's papers and the sabotaging of the Iran rescue, hostage rescue, and all the shenanigans. John Sears is a lobbyist in Washington to get the president's campaign manager, and Nofziger, the advisor to the president for the past 20 years. Well, Sears got $300,000 and Nofziger got $400,000. And then another guy who gained from this was Ron Book, and he helped work for the medical companies trying to get their deals through, and his offices got a large amount of money. They charted out a very good article charting out the people and the law offices that got so much money. Ron Buck at $1,750,000 in fees for this matter, pushing people to get these hospital plans through for this Ricari. And that must really be some character. I wonder when he'll surface, or if he ever will, or he'll join the floating circus of Frank Turple and Robert Vesco and Mr. Mike Ricari. So Ricari started his first hospital. He got control. It's called International Hospital. He only put $4,000 in. That's pretty good. He put $4,000 to start a hospital and ends up with $30 million a month from the federal government. Then he was involved with another lawsuit. Investors, some sided with him. It was an angry lawsuit, and they accused him of cheating and lying and lining his own pockets with company medicine. We talk about privatizing the medical community, and Mike Ricari got a $50,000 loan, interest-free loan from the hospital, and he built a condo for himself. He put $2,000 in his own condo, and he sold it for $500,000. By 1970, he had a small empire, and according to the story, the empire was hollow. The hospital was losing money. He didn't pay the medical supplies. There were complaints about their bad image, so he decided to form health clinics like his uncle had. He had one company called Health Maintenance Organizations, HMO, and then there was another company, International Medical Centers, and it was heavily in debt to Ricari, so they merged, and HMO, the Health Maintenance Organization, took over International Medical Centers. Then he got politicians to pay him to bring in the Cuban refugees. So he got $1 million a year when Castro released the prisoners. 10,000 families were automatically enrolled with health plans in Florida. I don't know how many of you are aware of that, how they got this health care, and no one else in the United States automatically gets that kind of health care, the farm workers and people working in factories. And you imagine coming in from Cuba and going to the hospitals run by Mike Ricari with seed money coming from the likes of Trafficante or Vesco. And then with Nofziger and Sears and Jeb Bush doing the pushing so that he could pull in $1 million a day from the federal government, and goodness knows how much he took with him. So he had these contracts, refugee contracts, for the Haitians. Now, I didn't know the Haitians and the Cubans were worth so much money, and he built up an empire on these refugees' medical plans. They must have been the best medicated or the best experimented. And what I'm worrying about is the experimentation of AIDS and how you can use a private hospital to give it or test it or spread it and then blame the Cubans or the Haitians. And goodness knows what went on. And how do you ever investigate or go back into those hospital plans and see what went on at the time? A state investigation began. And as I say, Ron Book, a key aide to Governor Graham, spoke in favor of Ricari's company. Somebody else who lobbied for him was Maria Elena Toreno from Jimmy Carter's administration. And Representative Claude Pepper, who was always interested in health and didn't know that we'd ever have a health plan in this country. And he has an aide, Jim Brennan, who is in Cuba. And a long time ago, Brennan was sick, and this uncle of McCary's saved his life. And so he said, yes, they're a great family. We'll get all this money for them. And so Claude Pepper, the Democrat, went along with that without questioning. Or how do we know we didn't question? He comes right out of the area of Trafficante, and John Roselli and the CIA and the anti-Castro Cubans. So he's very good on issues of the aging and getting money for the aged. But I'm sure he can't look the other way where the seed money comes and how it's spent down there for different kinds of purposes. Riccieri named a wing of the International Hospital after Claude Pepper's wife. And then Jeb Bush became a person working for him. And he works for the state of Florida and began to make phone calls that were key phone calls. In 1982, according to the story, Riccieri's ship really came in after he gave the $400,000 to Nofziger and the $300,000 to Sears and had Jeb Bush working, and his seed money in the Department of Health and Human Services created this pilot program for HMO, Health Maintenance Organization. And each month, the government would pay him 90% of the average Medicare payment, regardless of the patient's health. They didn't even have to be sick or didn't have to be critical. Whatever patients came through, the federal government was giving him a contract worth $24 million a year at that time. And by late 1986, he was worrying because the conditions were that 50% of the patients had to come from the outside, and he couldn't attract private businesses. So he was eyeing the big crowd in Florida, the elderly in Palm Beach, Tampa, and Broward. And he used political lobbyists and got exempt from the rule of having private people come in so that he could get all of his Medicare money. And the phone calls worked, and everything was going in his favor. Jeb Bush was quite prominent, as I say, along with these other biggies, and the health department went along with him. Now, once he got what he wanted, there was a fellow in the Health and Human Services in Washington named Juan Del Real. He was the government's top lawyer, and he quit his job. He was making $70,000 in Washington, and he started working for Riccieri and got $325,000 right away. And as I say, Mr. Haddow, who signed the waiver for him so that he could have all Medicare, not 50% outside, he got a $38,000 fee. And so this character ends up, and I keep emphasizing it, I'm in a state of shock, $30 million a month, $1 million a day. And Glenn Ford, the actor, was used to make TV commercials offering free eyeglasses to members, the IMC members, if they came in, and enrollment shot up, and all of a sudden, he had the second largest Hispanic-owned business in the nation. Now, WedTech was started by a person who lived in Puerto Rico a long time ago, and under the federal government giving business opportunities for those less likely to get a start, WedTech went off the ground, and the Puerto Rican background had very little to do with the profits, the scandals, the scams, the huge money investments, and the blind trust that Edwin Meese is involved in. And I'll do more about Meese and WedTech probably next week. So this Riccieri lived it up. And when a member of the Congress, Democrat Dan Mica, wanted to investigate it, he was told, get off the backs. Well, these people, a member of Congress, told him, get off the backs. He had a tiger by the tail, and then his life was threatened. One doctor threatened to fit Mica with concrete boots. And, of course, John Roselli was cut up and put in a drum off the bay out there, and his life was threatened. And he was told also, another, along with other persons, don't bother Riccieri, he's too powerful. And at the height of his power, and Congress unable to do anything, and death threats going, he skipped the country and went on his merry way. One interesting fact about Robert Vesco, a person approached for these operations, and of course his name runs all through the Watergate and the Howard Hughes story and Americana. He's so much part of the Americana scene. Vesco was very close to Francesco Franco when he was running his investment overseas operation. That was taken over by Willard Zucker, the banker for the National Security Council. And he had very close arrangements with Franco. And of course, out of Madrid came the offices with Franco and the CIA in Madrid, Otto Scorzeny and the team that worked down in Chile at Colonia Dignidad, and with Augusto Pinochet. And Vesco was helping at one time to overthrow the island of Dominica to make a Nazi stronghold. You remember members of the Klan and the Nazi, and they had armbands and swastikas, and they were going to take the island and make it the first Nazi island in the Caribbean, Robert Vesco. So this is a person working with Traffic Candy, and the connection of the vice president's son to all of this, you say, well, is the father responsible for what the son does? But no, the lobbyist that worked along with the son for this Rick Perry happens to be the one who was redesigning all the sub-cabinet positions in the White House, and George Bush, being the vice president, certainly should be knowledgeable about some of those people. If something happened to Reagan, he would be taking over as president, and there is Nofziger right in the White House and close to them, and Mr. Sears, the campaign manager for Reagan, and they're pushing for this character down in Florida who had these tremendous profits. And again, it's very dangerous to consider the possibility of what could go on in those hospitals. Now, I'll try to get on to some of the George Bush stories today. I just want to remind people that, and I opened up by saying George Bush was flying to Saudi Arabia and meeting there, and then telling McFarlane and North, wait, don't go to Iran till I come home from Saudi Arabia. And he's very close to Saudi Arabia. Ali North got a medal in the National Security Special Commendation with General Secord, sending the AWACS to Saudi Arabia. And Albert Hakim and Secord, particularly Secord, they've both been close to Saudi Arabia and North. And at the time of the Iran-Contra, the head of Saudi Arabia was in the White House, photographed with Ronald Reagan, and he was slipping something like $40 million or a million a week over to the Contras, making our foreign policy, for which we will have to be indebted someday, pouring money into Central America. Now, there were several articles on Saudi Arabia this past week that I thought were quite shocking, considering the proximity of the White House and the National Security Council and the vice president, the president. One of them was New York Times, December 28, 1987. Saudi king accuses Iran of hampering the fight with Israel. And the article goes on to say that the king of Saudi Arabia is angry at Khomeini and Iran for imposing ideologies on Muslim nations, that it is a detriment to their Arab campaign against Israel, that we are going to liberate Holy Jerusalem and Arab Islamic land in the Palestine controlled by Zionist colonialism, King Fayed said. And he met with the heads of Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and they all signed up together, and they said to Khomeini, come on, get with us. You're wasting too much time. We have to get rid of Israel. Now, there's a lot of attention of Israel in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, fighting to defend themselves against the uprising there, and that's another horrendous story. We can do more about this later. But I haven't heard a word about Saudis declaring war against Israel, which is inevitable. But I did read that Mubarak was in Saudi Arabia, and there's a love affair between the head of Egypt. And, of course, that Camp David Accord was not worth the piece of paper was written on. That was a meeting place that gave a chance for the secret team, a group called ITSCO with Secord and Edwin Wilson and Thomas Kleins and that group to make another many, many millions off of arms shipments that were supposed to go to Egypt because of the Camp David that were going to the PLO. And the secret team, just as they did in Iran-Contra, were making money off the Camp David Accord. And for all purposes now, that's being thrown down the drain. There was another article, Washington Post, December 28th, a coverage of the same meeting in the Middle East. This is the way it reads. Saudi asks Iran to join the fight against Israel. The other one says they're hampering the fight. And they said they have a regional reason that Israel will be the brunt of their war. And Fayed said he would bankroll Iran's post-war reconstruction period if they would stop fighting with Iraq and help us fight Israel. So they're getting ready to declare war on Israel. It's right there in the papers. And no commentary on the news. This has been a week now, not a word about it, and nobody seems to be shocked. Another story, I don't know whether it's sad or funny, and I think it has to do with secret money and secret deals, was the trip that Edwin Meese made to Paris January the 1st, just the last week or 10 days ago. He went over to pick up some art that was seized from Adnan Khashoggi. Now, this is a sleazy cover story. Mies is under fire across the board for about 20 different financial matters and shenanigans that should have brought him out of office before he ever became attorney general. He had financial problems before he was confirmed as attorney general, but he made a quick trip to Paris to pick up some paintings. One article from the San Jose Mercury, January 1st, said, Attorney General made a trip to Paris, France. He wasn't home for New Year's Eve, but on a very important White House business. He went to the United States Embassy and picked up more valuable paintings that were seized by the French police from Adnan Khashoggi. The Philippine government said the pictures were stolen from them, from President and Mrs. Marcos took them and spirited them to Khashoggi for safekeeping. And now Mies was going over to Paris. They wouldn't say which artist had painted them. Some were Degas paintings. A lawsuit was filed in the Philippines for the paintings, saying they belonged to the presidential palace and the Metropolitan Museum of Manila. Now, Sotheby art dealers have a way of sending artworks all around the world and insuring them. And paintings of this caliber that are in the embassy could be picked up and shipped. But I think Edwin Mies was on some very important business in Paris, and I'll bet you it isn't very far apart from the business of Mr. Inouye, Senator Inouye, making an arrangement for an $8 million school in Paris for children from South Africa, Jewish children. There's some kinds of deals, and I imagine they have to be surreptitious payoffs of Iran-Contra scandals that are going on over there, because this was a place, Mies doesn't have to go over there and pick up some paintings, and he goes off just when he's in the hot seat in this country to pick up some pieces of art. The article said that 38 pictures were given to Khashoggi to take to France. Khashoggi said he bought them. The sale was a subterfuge. He was acting as an agent for Marcos. The United States government said none of Marcos' things could be sold outside the country. There were 38 altogether. Khashoggi flew to Nice with them. He put them on his yacht. He stored them in Cannes, and then the French police came, and there were 21. So 17 were missing at that point. And when Ed Mies goes to Europe, he picks up a handful. There aren't the 21. Khashoggi gave up legal claim to 9 of the 21, and so the 9 paintings were supposed to be delivered in the embassy to Edwin Mies. I just can't believe he went all the way to Paris for 9 pictures that could have been shipped over anyway. It doesn't explain the 38, and of course, Khashoggi is wrapped all around the Iran-Contra affair so many times, and his name didn't come up at all either in any of the hearings or his involvement with people from the National Security Council, the CIA, only that he and his friend, Mr. Furmark, threatened to blackmail Edwin Mies. That's why Mies came out and had the news conference on the Iran scandal, because Khashoggi and Furmark were going to break the story, and Mies was between a rock and a hard place. And so I would guess that Mies' little trip to Paris had something more to do with Khashoggi than delivering art that once was stolen by Marcos and given to Khashoggi. There's Ben Stein in Los Angeles, who writes for the LA Herald, this horrible, I call him the successor to Roy Cohn, a very, very staunch conservative, wrote an article last August on Edwin Mies, attacking Edwin Mies' credibility, his financial shenanigans. And even though he is a staunch conservative, he said it breaks his mind or his thinking the way Ed Mies did business. And he said the attorney general is an intelligent man, but due to a life of public service, he's not wealthy. And so in order to make his life easier, he began investments. It strains credulity to believe that such a man would entrust $50,000 of his scarce capital to a blind trust managed by a man no one has ever heard of and who operates out of an apartment with no telephone. It's hard to believe that Mies would put up half or more of his assets into a wholly discretionary account run according to the vaguest rules. It is almost impossible for me to imagine Mies willingly gambling with that money in a way that any sensible investor would avoid like a retrovirus. And Mies to have chosen this investment advisor of all those in the world with extremely close ties to persons extremely close to WedTech makes the situation even more unfortunate. And Mr. Ben Stein is really hard on Mies and said there's no documentation of the trades that Mr. Chin made for Mies or WedTech. And it goes into the technicalities on how you do scams for the mafia or otherwise, and refers to Mies and America's business underworld. and Mr. Stein hit it on the head. What's going on with Nofziger and Wedeck and Nofziger down in Florida with that HMO case is that underworld. And, of course, one of the dangerous things, Wedeck makes weapons for the United States for security, but the other has health plans for Medicare and taking care of people, which they weren't doing, for large amounts of money that they were supposed to be taking care of these people. And imagine what happened to the medical condition as it went down. There were complaints at the hospital. And so the taxpayer, at a time where we hear there's a huge debt and problems with the budget, is coughing up money to goodness knows how many HMO people, how many Mike Riccieri's are there that don't even get in newspapers, much less one newspaper, the Miami Herald. I don't know if it ever even made the wire service. It's so hard to believe, and such a cast of characters of importance right directly into the White House, and so much money, and so many scams that are going on. This was one of the big ones, and I wanted to share it with you this evening. And then next week or so, we're going back to the occult, not only Colonia and the links of George Bush to that, but the occult, the murders, and the intrigue that seems to be weaving around many, many cities now. They're more conscious of it, and it's getting into the news. I want to conclude by saying that this past hour, this previous hour of World Watchers, was made possible in parts by Aries Arts in the heart of Capitola Village, serving Santa Cruz's growing consciousness for over 20 years. This is Mae Brussel, and I'll be back with you in just a few moments.